interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
Radio. It's all right once in a while, otherwise it tends to induce bad values, false dreams, lazy habits.
Listen to the Eclectic Ballroom 100 to 102 today FM. John Kelly here until 1 o'clock.
Written by Glenn Hansard, that's The Frames, and that's on demo tape, and the song is called Another Love Song.
Ryan Adams, come pick me up.
Thanks to Tom from Pet Sounds. This is Here Comes the Night.
Tonight's programme, until then, from me, John Peel. Good night and good riddance.
Radio's voice reaches everywhere throughout the land.
Hey, I can't find that on the radio.
It's in the air for you and me.
Yo, turn to that station.
Okay, let's begin.
What do you want? Punk rock girl by the Dead Milkmen? No, I don't know. Let me think. God, I mean, there's a thousand. Take the Skinheads Bowling by Camper Van Beethoven. I mean, if I just thought of just specifically those times, I can't really think of any one song that I would say sums it all up. I would possibly say Life During Wartime by Talking Heads. I mean, it's absolutely impossible to pick one song suddenly out of the blue, out of the whole thing. Where do I start?
Well, how about here? Dave Fanning trying to name one song that sums up his time presenting nighttime radio on 2FM. Considering he introduced thousands of new and emerging under-the-radar bands to the national airways for over 20 years, I guess it was an impossible question to answer on the spot. He did, however, name Talking Heads, and a few years ago in his book How Music Works, David Byrne wrote about how the world is now flooded with music. From the minute you wake up and turn on the radio, our everyday lives are drowned in sound, coming at us from all directions.
Your call is very important to us. Please hold.
Walk down any street and there's a constant boom coming from car stereos, restaurants, bars and shops. Chances are, if you're sitting on a train, you'll hear music bleeding out from personal headphones. Sites such as Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube means our search for music is now based on convenience and immediacy, which, let's be fair, is a great thing. As long as our laptop or phone is switched on, we can access the largest music store in the world and hear new music anytime, anywhere, anyplace. However, it's not that long ago where the weekly music papers, if you get them of course, and a handful of late night radio programs were the only way you could find out about, and more importantly hear non-chart music, with the presenters being a trusted friend who you could always rely on to introduce you to new music.
And it was just like, hey, this is really great. You know, I love it. I hope it does the same for you that it does for me. Well, at least you're going to get the chance to make your mind up about it, as opposed to, you know, reading about it and going, I wonder if, you know. And also, the other thing is that none of us were that far away from the kids who had to think very carefully about what they spent their money on where records were concerned, if you could get the records you wanted in the first place. One of the most obscure, I think there was only one copy of it in the country, but it was a song called A Thrill's a Thrill by Long John Baldry. And it's funny, when I meet people of my age and vintage now, they're kind of, oh, I love that program. Oh, do you know what I used to love? I used to love that song. And I could never get it anywhere.
A thrill's a thrill. A thrill's a thrill.
Mark Cagney there, who hosted the groundbreaking Night Train on RTE back in the 1980s. Programmes like The Night Train were presented by music obsessives who had a free hand in the choice of music they played, represented the underground, and provided an alternative for listeners on the lookout for music that didn't dominate the commercial world. Though some of the songs would eventually filter down and push into the mainstream.
I remember losing my religion by R.E.M. I was the first in the world to play that because I wasn't supposed to play it. I got this thing to listen to and I thought I was allowed to play it, and they had forgotten to tell me that I wasn't allowed to play it for a month or something. That kind of thing. There was always little bits and pieces like that. But I did get a lot of stuff up front.
Right, let's hit play on this intro and see what happens. Well, don't know about you, but for me, an instant memory flash there. Suddenly I'm 14, sitting in my bedroom, listening to the radio, pretending to be doing my homework. That was Fleetwood Mac's Oh Well Part 1, which Dave Fanning used as his theme tune during the 1990s. Many who listened into these programmes back in the 80s were the first generation of music pirates. Sitting by the radio, one finger hovering over the record button, waiting for the presenter to hit play on their favourite band's comeback single weeks before it would ever be released. This was something Olaf Tyrensen was reminded of when he heard an old Edie Brickell song playing in a bar earlier this year.
I used to home tape and kill the industry. Like a lot of people, you'd be beside your radio or your stereo or whatever with the blank cassette in and your finger poised over the record button. And when a song you liked came on, you know, you capture it. But of course, quite often you would then capture the machine gun riffs of Fanning or the smart horse ones of Ryan, you know, speaking at the beginning of the record or at the end of it. So lots of songs that I recall. And the Edie Brickell thing came up, it was on in a bar that I was in, one of the tracks came on, which is why I was asked, oh, did he know that when it came out? And as the song came to an end, I think it was What I Am was the song. I half expected to hear, like it triggered this memory of Cagney's voice going, you know, that's lovely, that's Edie Brickell, yeah, you know, that kind of thing. Probably because I listened to that cassette 100 times, 200 times, whatever it might have been.
These radio programmes shaped the musical tastes of several generations in a pre-digital era. They offer the listener a way of connecting to a world way beyond theirs, while also opening up the possibility of there actually being a life beyond the edge of town. On a farm outside the small village of Rathmore in Kerry, a young Donald Aneen had his life changed forever when his dad arrived home with a magic box under his arm after a good day at the mart.
This tape recorder with a radio arrived, and I don't know, within a day or two it was in my room, and from that point on, that plus me was my world. Just a single red light on that machine, the aerial and a window looking out onto the sort of giant pre-internet screensaver called the Sky, and then just night times from then on it was that and nothing else. And so that represented some kind of connection to something. There's a piece that Seamus Heaney wrote when he accepted the Nobel Prize about the wireless, about looking at it and kind of imagining something about, I guess, the provenance of where the sound was coming from, looking at the cities and all that kind of very romantic idea.
I had to get close to the actual radio set in order to concentrate my hearing. And in that intent proximity to the dial, the names of foreign stations, of Leipzig and Oslo and Stuttgart and Warsaw, had already begun a journey into the wideness of the world.
That same romance was present when I was discovering radio, because for me it was like a connection to something that I was really desperately trying to find. So radio really took over in terms of just the thing that took me out of my world and provided me with this space to dream and be something else. So to me it just seems like there's some magic in that machine.
Chances are, if you grew up listening to these programmes, at least half your record collection is now filled with bands you heard for the first time on late night radio, as you sat in your bedroom or bedsit rebelling against the world. Here's Jim Holmes remembering the first time he heard a track from an album he's still obsessed with today.
I was age 17, living on my own in Flatland. I was a new civil servant, as it was, working for Ampust. So I played sports, as you did, but then your evenings were all pretty much on your own. Now, I had a telly with a video, but a video was £5 to rent each night. So music was paramount to my life. there was a handful of late night talk, they weren't even talk shows, they were music shows solely, and it would have been Dave Fanning, and he was the master at it. Now, there was a lot that would have been way over my head, say at age 17, but there would be occasions where all of a sudden this gem would be played. And you had to scramble. You had to get a paper and a pen at hand, because there was no internet. You couldn't see back to see what was played. You never got through to radio stations in those days. So you'd scribble it down and you'd be getting snippets of things, and then you're trying to stitch them with other friends if you only half it to see what it was or what it wasn't. But I remember one night Dave played, he said, and like that, going at about 100 miles an hour, the way he used to talk, and this next song is off the forthcoming Talk Talk album. And straight away everything was quiet and almost scary and eerie. And it opened up with a kind of a rhythmic drum that you didn't know where this was going, and then this really whiny bass. And I think it was the first time I'd ever heard the bass guitar used the way it was. I couldn't believe that this sound could actually be made. I couldn't believe there was something different out there for a start. And the rest was history. You wrote down the name of the song, which didn't matter because the name of the album was The Colour of Spring, and that was the album that changed my life. Makes you feel much older,
sublime, blind, right. Jim Holmes on how Talk Talk blew his mind listening to them on late night radio in Flatland in 1980s Ireland. And that's the beautiful thing about radio. It's a transient thing. You never know what's going to be played next, and maybe, just maybe, it could be that one song, The Lightning Bolt, that will completely change your life.
It was on one of those stations that I heard Pretty Vacant in the middle of the night, around 2 a.m, when I was at home reading The Enemy in bed during summer holidays in school. And I literally got out of the bed to stare at the radio. I was so excited about it. I'd never heard anything like it in my life. It's hard to describe just the effect a song can have on you. It's just, it spoke to me from the word go. And that changed my life, literally changed my life.
Twenty years later, Tom Dunn found himself on the other side of the microphone presenting Pet Sounds on Today FM. Never mind the bollocks, celebrates its 40th anniversary next year, and 1977 is as good a place to start as anywhere as we go left of the dial to tell the story of how alternative music programmes once ruled the national nighttime airways. ...1977 was a pivotal year at the birth of what we might call a modern urban Irish music scene. The Rats were on top of the pops, Hot Press magazine started, and a bunch of upstarts at Trinity College brought the Clash to town. Ian Wilson was president of the Students' Union.
This is the middle of the Troubles in the north, and the bombs had just kicked off, and nobody, no commercial promoter, was taking any bands in at all. The commercial music scene imploded in Ireland, and it was only the colleges doing business. When I became president of the Students' Union, we had a very bright mate of mine, Paul Tipping. And so we went on a full, we went for it. We brought in the Clash, and we brought in the Stranglers, and the Buzzcocks, and the Adverts, and so, and the college, needless to say, went apeshit.
At that gig were future members of bands like U2, the Virgin Prunes and the Blades, and writing for Rolling Stone magazine in 2004, The Edge described it as a life-changing experience, adding, the Clash more than any other group kick-started 1,000 garage bands. Meanwhile, Ian Wilson would go on to produce The Dave Fanning Show on RTE. Wild one, won't you please come home? You've been away too long, will ya? For much of the decade, Irish rock had been in exile with the likes of Thin Lizzy, Rory Gallagher and Van Morrison, all escaping to London to further their careers. The punk explosion changed everything. Hey, it's good to be back home again. Okay, so Dickie Rock may have been number one in June 77, but if you look further down the charts, you'll spot a band called The Radiators from Space. Believe it or not, the band's debut single, Television Screen, was the first punk song to make it into a top 20 pop chart anywhere in the world. 13 at the time, Robbie Martin was fascinated by the punk look attitude and sound. However, it wasn't all that easy to actually hear the music he wanted to hear.
It was in 1977 when the punk explosion first hit, and I was very impressionable at that stage because I was only 13 years of age. At that stage, I couldn't buy records because I was only a kid. I couldn't ask Mammy to go out and buy Never Mind the Bee because she's going to question the name of the album. Couldn't hear the slightest bit of punk rock at all whatsoever, so one had to spend their time twiddling the dial to get in these pirate stations, which were very hard to tune in, and you could have it tuned in and set on the radio and turn it on one night and it's not there, so then you're off again searching for another station, but eventually you would find it. I would have been lost because I wouldn't have known what was out there. In the whole punk scene, I wouldn't have known the names of the bands, I wouldn't have known the albums or the songs, so that the radio, pirate radio, gave you what you needed before you went to the record shop, so you could go and buy what you actually heard and what you know and what you liked, rather than taking a punt and saying, well, I'll take this album and maybe I'll like it or I won't like it.
Transmitting unlicensed broadcasts from bedrooms and garden sheds across the city and country, the pirates were rocking by the end of the decade. The government's attempt to kill them off was to set up a second national radio station, and on the 31st of May 1979, blasting out Boomtown Rats, Radio 2, or 2FM as it was to become, was launched.
This is RTE Radio 2. It's 23 minutes to 1 o'clock, and to present Pop Around Ireland, here is Larry Gogan.
Thank you very much indeed, Brendan, and welcome to the first show on Radio 2.
Future household names such as Larry Gogan, Marty Whelan and Vincent Hanley could suddenly be heard broadcasting to the nation and playing all the hits of the day. At night, and after all the important dramas of the day had been played out, the music broadened and the national airwaves became a portal to a different world. Down in Enniscorthy, the arrival of a new youth-orientated station in 1979 couldn't have come at a better time for Peter Murphy, who, as an 11-year-old kid, was trying to adjust to life without a TV.
Kempes, he's got the acceleration. He's got the shot. For Tony! Yes! It's 3-1 and that's the World Cup!
My mother got rid of the television. This is documented in my first novel, John the Revelator. It was after the World Cup in 1978, which was a beautiful summer, a scorching summer. But my brothers had spent the entire summer indoors watching the World Cup. So my mother was so sort of incensed by this heathen behaviour that she got rid of the television. So radio was an absolute lifeline for me and for my brothers. The launch in 1979 of an actual youth-oriented pop music station was a big deal. You know, there was this extraordinary thing happening whereby you could not just hear the pop hits of the day, and it was an incredibly fertile period as well, it's worth remembering. You had The Jam and Blondie and Two Tone and all the ska stuff, and the new wave of British heavy metal, and, you know, it was incredibly diverse. That was a great era for pop music and a great era for Radio 2 to be starting up, but also it was the first wave of what we might call an Irish counterculture, in other words, punk and new wave.
The punk explosion of 77 had fired the imagination of kids across the country. The DIY attitude had kicked down musical and social barriers, and what emerged in the aftermath of punk was a vibrant and exciting local music scene, out of which would come a band that would go on to conquer the world.
I liked them more than I liked their music, I think, which is a really strange thing, because I just thought they were, I just liked them as blokes, and I didn't necessarily think that their music was, it didn't hit me like the Rats was hitting me or like the Undertones were hitting me, not at all. And then we did the most bizarre thing with the first single. I can't understand, like, think of a band now who nobody knows, I mean, except for a few people around Dublin who knew you two. I don't know why we did 5 nights in a row, brought them in and let the listeners decide on the A side and the B side of their first single, those were the vinyl days. I still don't know why we did it. but we did.
Is that the one? Stories for Boys is the second of three you're going to hear from U2 tonight. Out of Control with the first one. Whichever one you think should be the A side of their brand new and very first single, you can send it in to me, Dave Fanning, and I'll give you the address. I think it's U2.
On the Radio 2 schedule from day one, the Dave Fanning Show played a central role in the re-energised Irish music scene of the 1980s, becoming a facilitator for countless bands like U2 to break through and get their music heard. Ian Wilson, a veteran of student politics and pirate radio, was programme producer.
And they decided to set up the station. I applied for the job. And a lot of us from the Big D, mainly, but other pirate stations, got jobs there. And given I had a college education, I had a background, an proven administrative background, organisational background because of the students' union, and all this side, and I knew music fairly well, and I had some involvement. I got one of the six or seven jobs at the start, a producer jobs at the start of 2FM. And that's where it started, and we made a very heavy lobby to bring the kind of programme Dave Fanning be doing. Dave Fanning be doing sort of what had become quite a really sort of massive cult programme. Midnight, his mad sort of late night radio programme on Big D. I knew Dave fairly well at this stage, so obviously. So they put me in with Dave, and we kicked off at midnight on May the 31st. We came up with this sig tune, The Only Ones, Another Girl, Another Planet.
Following John Peel's lead in the UK, the Fanning Show quickly became the voice of the underground music scene here, and the playing of demos on the national airwaves was a radical step back in 1979. From our house, here's Dave Cowse.
Imagine they played demos in those days. That's how exciting it was. You just went in for with 50 quid and you made a demo and you just lashed it out and hoped for the best. And then you sent it out to RTE and you waited and you waited. And you were lucky enough you got a call. You said, oh, we really like your demo, we're going to play it on the radio. And I remember specifically my first play. I remember it was a song called Freak Out. It was years ago, 85. And Fanning came on and he said, this is Dublin Band, Our House. And he played it. Like, and he got called us Dublin Band, Our House. Forever.
Every time you hear a shot. And next coming up we have Dublin Band, A House. Yeah, every time, time, Dave, you know.
At least I play the records.
I know you play them, yeah, I know. I mean, Dublin Band, A House, every time.
We never became anything other than that. And I remember that we were so beside ourselves with joy listening to ourselves on the radio. We'd really arrived. I remember it vividly. Like, it was just such an arrival for us. We have arrived. We are now somebody. We're no longer just a garage band playing for ourselves. We've just been broadcast to the entire nation. Somebody in Cork maybe just liked what they heard. Our creation, you know, and that inspires you to go on. And you know, it's just all. It was a start. Brilliant start.
Another band who enjoyed early support from the Fanning Show were the Blades.
Let there be you, let there be me, let there be oysters under the sea, let there be rainbows, a lark and a dove, but most of all, please let there be love. One, two. You hear that, sir?
Here's frontman Paul Cleary.
Fanning was a great facilitator and people like him, because you knew you could write a song in your bedroom in Ringsend, work hard, chip away, write the song, make sure it was good as you thought. But it wouldn't end there. If it was good and you recorded it reasonably well, Fanning would play it, you know. It was just, it's a great thing. You know, it sounds so simple now, but really it was so, so important for kids, particularly working class kids like ourselves who had no connections with nobody in. We knew worked in RT. We'd no connections in the music business. Our dads were bus conductors and, you know, just normal people earning a crust. And so we knew nobody. We had no contacts as such. And I'm not playing the poor mouth here and wanting anyone to cry. But again, that's the way it was then. That sort of scene, that music business scene, music production, radio stations, we were absolutely clueless. We really didn't know. So we needed people like Fanning to say, look, we'll play your stuff. Give us your stuff and if it's good, we'll play it. It was so helpful to us. It wasn't one of those moments where we were all around the radio. I'd love to say it was. I was just in the kitchen and I just heard it. And I remember my little heart racing a bit. because I went from being somebody who wanted to be in a band and wanted to write songs to very suddenly being somebody who was in a band who was writing songs and their song was being played on national radio. It all happened very, very quickly. Particularly that sort of stage of our career, what we laughingly call our careers, was it just happened very quickly. So there it was. I went from somebody who was struggling to sort of finger a few chords and in the bedroom to somebody who had actually written a song, had recorded it in a decent studio, and it was never been played on national radio. That's how I saw it. So that was a big leap. And I'm sure there were a lot of bands like us who felt the same.
Oh, unbelievable. I was in Cormac Wright's house. Cormac Wright was the guitar player. His dad was Sean Wright, the barber in Kilmainham. And we used to rehearse in his shop. He claims that the loud music made the front of the shop move forward and cost him thousands of pounds, and I don't really believe that's true. But we used to go up afterwards to Cormac's upstairs, so we would listen to see if Dave would play us, and we nearly fell over dead when he played us. It was like nothing else on earth to hear yourself on the radio. It was beyond your wildest dreams. You just felt like you could walk on air afterwards. You really felt like you were part of this huge, you know, establishment of bands. Like you'd name check huge bands and then you'd get a play as well. It was sensational. It really made you want to do it and try harder and practice harder and take it more seriously. Very inspiring.
Tom Dunn on the joy of that all-important first radio play. After a year on air, Ian Wilson managed to persuade management to hand over the keys to the Montrose recording studio, where he could invite bands to RTE for a free lunch in the canteen, and more importantly, the opportunity to record four tracks, which would then be aired on The Fanning Show. To get the ball rolling, there was only one band he could call on.
I persuaded them to let us use the existing recording studio. There was a recording studio in the place, which at the time would have been kind of Rolls-Royce equipped, but it was very rarely used. So after a little bit of work, I managed to get them to agree to let us use the facility. The first thing I did was I said, I want to find a good band. Let's go in and see. I have no idea what's in this studio, what anything sounds like. So I rang up Paul McGinnis and said, look, come in, will you? Come in, we'll just do a trial. We don't know how this room performs. Our guys haven't done many music, noisy bands in this room. We don't know what the... You know. So in came U2 and they did seven songs straight to stereo. And so began the Fanning sessions.
Wilson knew exactly what he was doing. Like, he was a veteran of a lot of student wars in Trinity College, head events and students' unions, and spent a night in jail for occupying the library for more fees and all this kind of stuff. And or arrested anyway. He really knew what to do. There's a Studio 8 lying idle, not being used, and I just let Wilson fight the powers that be. Not that there was too much fighting, but there's an element of the fact that they get a licence fee, so they needed to do what would be called some public service broadcasting. So we did about 40 sessions a year or so for a period of 20, 25 years, and the point about that is it was a box majorly ticked for Irish bands.
Our goal in life was to get something that created that we good enough, if we were lucky enough and talented enough to create something that warranted being played on the radio. And the goal, of course, was the Fanning session, because that was the first step to stardom, basically. So you had to get that. Like, so when the news came through that we got a Fanning session from Ian Wilson, we were just beside ourselves with joy. Like, and that was where it all started. It was vital. It was everything to bands of our era. And I remember going in, well, it was all very professionally done. There was always a producer there. Ian Wilson did a couple of them. And, you know, there was those beautiful recording rooms. It was so exciting. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, we were only like, you know, 18, 19, like, you know, when we were starting our musical career, and you were in this lovely big recording studio with a producer and an engineer, and we got all very posh. This is before we got to record properly, like, you know, our first single, you know. But things changed after that, you know, because then you became more, I suppose you had the machine of record company behind you.
Dave Cowes on the importance of getting to record a Fanning session in the early days with his band, Ahas. Another presenter on the Radio 2 schedule from day one was Mark Hagney.
I go out walking after midnight, out in the moonlight, just like we used to do. I'm always walking after midnight, searching for you.
The idea of doing your own late night FM type album show was just It was the kind of stuff that, I won't say dreams were made of, right, but it was like, oh God, you could indulge yourself, you could play your stuff, you could play what you thought was cool. Essentially, what I was doing was I was playing the music that myself and my friends loved. So, happy days. I think if you were to pick an album or an artist that kind of epitomised Night Train, it would be John Martin and Solidaire, that album. Almost anything off it, its vibe, the delivery, it sort of summed it up in terms of the vibe we were trying to exude and what it was, the atmosphere and the ambience that you're... Essentially, what were we there to do? I mean, apart from indulging my own musical taste, I was there to send people to sleep. But I was happy to... I mean, most people would be offended by that, you know. We even thought about getting t-shirts going, you know. I went to bed with Mark Cagney last night, but nobody would sort of stump up the money for it, and RT certainly wouldn't.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of Pet Sounds and Revolver, two releases that shifted the focus of pop from single to album and kick-starting the golden era of the LP. Mark's late-night programmes very much reflected this shift, and he was helped when he discovered a treasure trove of music buried out in Montrose.
What none of us would have anticipated was is that we were in a place that had the best music collection possibly in the British Isles, because all of the record companies had been supplying RTE and the RTE library with all of the music pretty much since the foundation of broadcasting. And it had been lying in the RTE library pretty much unused, bar the odd sponsored programme, for donkey's years. So I remember getting the keys, or not getting the keys, but being allowed into the library and going looking for stuff, going into the Rolodex and the Index. And just, you know, you play this little game of, you know, I remember reading about the so-called very first American heavy metal record, which is a thing called Inagada de Vida by Iron Butterfly, which I'd only ever read about. I had never heard it. I'd never been able to buy it. You know, people take an awful lot for granted now. It's, oh, I'll get it on Amazon, I'll have it, or whatever the hell. I mean, these, like, in a lot of cases, the really cool records that we wanted, you had to rely on somebody going on holidays to America, or somebody sending it on to you, or a contact. So I just went, you know, somebody said to me, you have no idea, like, it's Aladdin's Cave down there, you can get anything. And I went, oh, I bet you they don't have Iron Butterfly. There, went on, there was a mint copy of it. And there was loads of that kind of stuff. So for music lovers, there was an opportunity to actually get your hands on all of the stuff that you'd read about. Stuff that was kind of legend, almost. We were allowed the run of the place for, well, in my case, nearly 11 years, which was like putting kids in charge of the candy shop.
Throughout the mid-80s, you get your music fixed with Radio 2 from 8 o'clock for Fanning, Ryan and Cagney.
The thing about it is, once 8 o'clock came, they didn't really care about us too much. So for about 6 years, it was a golden time in some ways, because it was me 8 to 10, Jerry Ryan 10 to 12 and Mark Cagney 12 to 2. Cagney would play the kind of the more quality album tracks, so stuff that I'd like too. I was playing all the new stuff, and Jerry didn't know what he was playing. He was playing his own brain, frankly. I mean, I remember one time Jerry was talking to a guy at night who was a typical kind of Irish person who won a competition. Yeah, no, okay, hello, right. Like, he wasn't saying anything. He was just like, he was coming across as thick as a plank, like a lot of people in the radio do when they win something. And I remember Jerry said, okay, well, listen, Tom, thanks for entering the competition. Yeah, and good luck with the lobotomy. Oh, thanks, Jerry. He was like, oh my God. But like, there was a lot of that kind of stuff. Jerry was slightly mad, perfect for nighttime.
The Fanning Ryan Cagney segment of radio quickly became a cult attraction, essential listening for anyone wanting to hear music you just couldn't get anywhere else. In Wexford, Peter Murphy was tuning into the Fanning show.
There was a crucial point, I can't remember the year, but there was a point where Fanning show was moved from midnight to 8 o'clock, I think, and that was like the point in The Wizard of Oz where the world goes from black and white to multicolor. I don't know if Ian Wilson and Dave Fanning had much of a fight in terms of holding on to their playlist or their aesthetic, having shifted to a much broader audience, but to my ears, it didn't change very much at all. First time I ever heard the Pogues, the Boys from the County Hell, that single was 83 or 84. The first time I heard REM, Radio Free Europe, 83, 84. The Go-Betweens, the Go-Go's, incredibly wide span of taste. And the great thing about Dave was he was a Joni Mitchell fan, so he'd throw in a Joni Mitchell track in between two sort of unlistenable demos. So that universe that happened between 8 and 10, you know, sonically went from Your Mates Down the Road all the way up to, you know, classic Rolling Stones or The Who or whatever.
Down in Kerry, Donal Deneen was on board the night train, though his mother was a little worried about the influence it was having on him.
More attention to your schoolwork and less to the radio.
You always listen to the radio.
It's different. Our lives are ruined already. You still have a chance to grow up and be somebody.
I remember my mom just, you know, who never gave out to me about anything, but who looked at my Intercept results after a couple of years of listening to the radio and said, well, what are you doing in that room? Like, well, and the answer was nothing apart from listening to music and listening to the radio. I think I would have started listening to Jerry Ryan and really liked that, and then probably realised that, oh, the guy on after is more into music, so that was Mark Cagney. So I would have ended up there for definitely for a couple of years, and it would have really informed my taste in the early days. And I loved sort of music that was melancholic or sad in some way, and there was lots of that on that programme. Still, some of those things that were on that show I would still like the Blue Nile probably being the best example. So radio really took over in terms of just the thing that took me out of my world and provided me with this space to dream and be something else.
Meanwhile, out west in Galway, Olaf Tyrinson was enjoying all three shows, not locked away in his bedroom, but sitting out in his dad's car.
My younger sister was born when I was 12, and my next younger sister was born when I was 21, so the baby was in the bedroom next to mine, and I kept on driving my mother mad by waking the baby up by playing music. So what I used to do was go out and sit in my dad's car. He had various cars over the years, but one of them I remember was a Ford Sierra Estate with good speakers and all the rest. So I'd just sit in the car and either play cassettes or listen to the radio. The other advantage too was that I could smoke. You know, every now and again my mother would sort of, the curtains would be drawn and she'd look out and be like, hide the cigarette, you know. I got caught many times, but eventually they realised it was just easier, let them off, you know. And funnily enough, I don't drive. My love of cars extended only to the stereo, you know, and the ashtray. I mean, Fanning was the most music-orientated show in terms of Irish music and in terms of new Irish music. Ryan, as I recall, there was a lot of talk and phone-ins, and, you know, and he listened to, you know, to that for other reasons. And then Cagney, sort of the cool late-night sort of thing. And tracks like Robbie Robertson's Somewhere Down the Crazy River, I seem to recall, you know, that's something that Cagney would play. And so all three of them introduced me to some great music.
By the end of the decade, Cagney and Ryan had both made the switch to daytime. Dave Fanning continued to rock out in the evenings and fully appreciates now how lucky he was to be involved in radio during that period.
For a golden time, it really was pretty special. But it was mainly because, I have to be honest, there was nobody else. So we were very lucky. I mean, we were really lucky. It's like, I suppose, Roger Daltrey, actually, The Who. And he was talking about something recently. He didn't really get the fact that he was so lucky and I interviewed Roger Waters, actually, that was it as well, that they were so lucky to be around the time. Okay, they might have made great music, and they might have made long-lasting music like Dark Side of the Moon or Quadrophenia, whatever it happens to be, but they were so lucky to have been around at a time when everything they were doing was breaking down a barrier, regardless of them doing this. The barrier was being broken down simply because they were, it was like an offshoot of what they were doing. If they were doing that now, they would never be heard by so many people. It just isn't the same. It's all different. And they were lucky to have been there at a time. So if comedy is about timing, then certainly life is without a doubt about timing. And we were just really lucky to be there at a certain time on radio, in the same way as those bands I mentioned earlier on were lucky to be there doing what they were doing at the time they were doing it, because the time is bigger than you are.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, Happy New Year! Happy New Year! Dave Fanning on stage at the Point Depot, New Year's Eve, 1989, welcoming U2 to the stage. Just 10 years after allowing them to take over his radio programme for a week, the band were making plans for world domination.
Throwing a party for ourselves in years. It's no big deal, just we have to go away and just dream it all up again.
Fast forward another 10 years, the arrival of a new millennium, and the music industry itself was having to dream it up all over again. Technology was slowly changing the way we bought, carried, and listened to music. Hip-hop and dance influenced pop culture in the 90s, much like punk had done in the 70s and throughout the 80s.
Hey all you kids out there, welcome to 3 Feet High and Rising. Now, here's what we do.
See, 30 years ago you had the first digital samplers and they changed everything overnight. All of a sudden artists could sample from anything and everything that came before them. From a snare drum, from the Funky Meters, for a Ron Carter bass line, you know, the theme to The Price is Right. Albums like De La Soul's 3 Feet High and Rising and the Beastie Boys Paul's Boutique looted from decades of recorded music to create these sonic layered masterpieces that were basically the Sgt. Pepper's of their day.
Mark Ronson there, and a clip from his TED Talk about how sampling transformed music. Many of the biggest hits from the last 25 years have borrowed from the past.
Ooh, Lord, ain't my trouble so hard.
Sampling old blues and gospel voices from Alan Lomax's American Field Recordings and layering them with dance grooves, Moby's Play album went on to sell over 12 million copies worldwide.
Trouble with God. Ooh, Lord, trouble so high. Ooh, Lord, trouble so high.
That idea of blending the old with the new was brilliantly captured on two radio programs that took to the national airwaves in March of this year.
My name's Bond. James Bond.
This is BBC television from London. Diana, Princess of Wales, has died after a car crash in Paris.
Just as if Tyson bared his teeth at one stage in the exchange.
Yes,
bit his ear.
He bit his ear.
There it is, 10 o'clock, and we say Tony Blair is to be Prime Minister and a landslide.
Field in the Crucible Third belongs to Ken Doherty, who beat Stephen Hendry.
Early today, as he left a party in Los Angeles, Wallace, also known as Biggie Smalls, was shot from a passing vehicle.
Seems like yesterday we used to rock the show. I laced the track, you locked the flow.
So Today FM, or Radio Ireland as it was known then, launched on St. Patrick's Day 1997. Similar to the early days of Radio 2, once 7pm arrived and the lights had been switched off for the day, the nighttime presenters were given the chance to open up their record collection and take the listener on a musical journey that might start with an early American folk song.
Well, who's that riding? Who's that riding?
And finish with a track off the new Spiritualized album. And it was the successful nighttime partnership of John Kelly and Donald Dineen brought us on these nocturnal adventures in sound.
Good radio, music radio, just simply a person and music. It's a way of telling a story. It's storytelling with added knobs, you know, and buttons and faders. And it really is like that. And I think, you know, the key people that I learned that from, like Mark Cagney, and BP Fallon, Giles Peterson. But then just at the time that I started to get the chance to do it, John Kelly was probably one of the best examples of a storyteller. He didn't need a lot of tools to tell that story. You know, it might come across like he's got the Smithsonian Library behind him, but in actual fact, he may have just a small bunch of CDs and a pencil.
The Eclectic Ballroom.
The one before that, in case you do wish to record it, is by Ginny Arnell. I wish I knew what dress to wear. I've got a million of these now.
They call me Dr. Jones, known as the Night Tripper.
Myself and Donald weighed in the evenings with, I think in Donald's case, a cardboard box, and in my case, a sort of sports bag full of records or CDs. So I suppose that the point was for myself and for Donal is that we had this kind of hinterland of being actual music fans, and the resource that we had was our own music collection, and we knew our way around our respective music collections pretty well. You're not just some random person who wants to be on the radio or wants to be on the telly or whatever it is. The point is, since I was a teenager, my early teens, I was obsessively listening to music, and not only listening to it, reading about it, studying it, reading books about it. When I was old enough, travelling to the places that the music came from, whether it was Memphis or New Orleans or Nashville or New York or any of these places, to find not just the musicians who were still knocking around, but in those days, to find the records. So there was a lot of love and care that went into that programme. That web of music, that one thing leads to another, was my hobby, was my passion. It was my whole life, actually, and it was also my personality. So that all helped, and that made it... That made it a pleasure for me, and that must have communicated itself in some way through the programme.
Radio Ireland struggled in the early days, but the chaos surrounding the station actually helped the nighttime programmes to evolve and develop into something special.
Insight, foresight, more sight. The clock on the wall reads a quarter past midnight.
In the lifetime of the first few months, there was so much chaos with, like, chief executives and program managers all leaving and being replaced within a few weeks, and that was happening 4, 5, 6 times definitely in the first year, that we sort of got left to our own devices. So I think it was there that the seeds were sown. So it could easily have been a case that within a first few weeks they would have gone and get rid of those weirdos, but we just somehow managed to survive simply because the whole daytime thing was just crashing all over the place, so there was no attention really to what was going on. So in that time, it became just some sort of, like, I don't know, fertile ground where it was like being left to our own devices in the dark.
We thought the building was haunted. There were lights coming on, doors closing, you know, and it was an old hospital, so it was quite weird at night. Odd things would happen. You'd look up and Dermot Morgan would be standing there shouting at you, you know, because he was in doing something else. Or, you know, I had Van in there one day and I brought him into Donal. I think Donal nearly fell off his chair when he looked up and there was Van Morrison, you know.
Radio!
So it was a good time, and anarchic, crazy in lots of ways. It wasn't like work for me, you know. It wasn't work at all. I'd just turn up and play music. I'd be playing at home, and I was playing it with the same, you know, approach, which was every night. It was almost like, will you hear this? The way you would in the house with your mates, you know, I've just got this new record. The good thing for me musically was that I really hit it off with Donal, and we were doing something completely different and yet coming from the same place. And musically, I was learning a lot from him and vice versa. I think I was introducing him to a lot of older music, old Stax music, soul music, jazz, R&B. He was picking up on from me, and I was hearing a lot of stuff from him that I didn't know, more of the contemporary stuff. I mean, it was him introduced me to DJ Shadow, for instance, and that led me down a few pathways. There was a lot of goodwill towards it. I think people recognised it was honest, it was fun, it was a bit mad, it was never going to last. You know, and it didn't.
Like any good music programme, the Eclectic Ballroom and Here Comes the Night quickly became a gateway for the listener to discover new music, with the presenters being part educator, part companion. Here's Richie Egan from Jape and the Redneck Manifesto, and having Donald and Ian soundtrack those long, dark, late-night road trips home after playing a gig.
Localised flooding is likely, especially in southern counties. It'll be mild, though, with lowest temperatures 8 to 10 degrees Celsius. 100 to 102, Today FM News and Information, more at 11.
100 to 102 Today FM.
Thank you for joining us live on the air.
Here comes the night.
You and me, we can work this out. We can get it done. We
would tend to drive back from a gig if it's not too far, say Galway, it's like 2.5 hours, and it's actually easier to drive back afterwards because there's no traffic and stuff. And we would always be listening to Donald and Ian on the way home, always. And it got to the point at the start where we would just listen, but then after we got to kind of know Donald, we could text in and we'd be in the van and he'd be sort of dedicating a track to us, or we would go, oh great track, play Cody Chestnut there, brilliant Donald, and he would sort of say, this is for the guys travelling back there from Galway now. And like, it's just so interactive. It's like having your own, I'm not going to say jukebox because we wouldn't tell Donald what to play, but like having some sort of jukebox you can talk to. He will talk back to you in a friendly manner. Also, just his music choices were always so good, you know, we'd be blasting the music in the van, always.
Well, Tom Dunn had plenty of nights zigzagging across the country with his band Something Happens, but by 1999, the band had split and he found himself taking over John Kelly's slot to present a new programme called Pet Sounds.
Star, star, teach me how to shine, shine, teach me so I know what's going on in your mind. I don't understand these people saying the hill's too steep.
John Kelly had established reputation for a strong alternative type of show at that point. And John's taste is much more eclectic than mine. So I kind of knew when I came in that I would be opening up the doors to a broader range of tastes. I've more popular palate taste-wise than John. And I had loads of stuff I really, really wanted to do. I felt an awful lot of Irish bands were very strong and deserved more airplay. The Frames were my go-to band for all this, because I had toured America and I'd seen bands that weren't remotely as good as the Frames, but which had much cooler reputations in Ireland. And it was just because they were from America. And I thought, we're just not giving local bands the kind of kudos they deserve. So I was playing as many of them as I could and getting them into the studio, and it was great. And there weren't that many people doing that at the time. It was a real alternative to 2FM. So it just had a rock and roll, and then Donald and Ian coming on after you, it was a great little swing of the evening, and I loved it. And I was listening to music all the time, discovering new people, and it was a good time. There were good albums coming out. Two tracks came in on the same day. There Goes the Fear from Doves and Badly Drawn Boys' Silent Sigh. They came into my desk on the same day, and I'd say they were the two opening songs on the show for the next 3 weeks afterwards. You know, they were just so amazing. You could go in with the cares of the world on your shoulders for whatever reason, whatever's going on in your life, and 2 hours later you would have completely forgotten about any of that, and you wouldn't want the show to end, and you just want to play more music and get really, really into it. Wonderful experience. I mean, for that to be your job is fairly unbelievable. Amazing.
Programs like Pet Sounds and Here Comes the Night quickly built a cult following, and just as Tom Dunn and Donald and Ian have made that connection through the radio back in the 1980s, a new generation were doing likewise in the 90s. Here's Nadine O'Regan.
Growing up in Skibbereen, I had very limited access to what you might call alternative or indie rock music, music that was more independently spirited. So I remember very particularly hearing Donald and Ian, John Kelly, Tom Dunn, those presenters in particular just sort of reached out, and they were so invested in what they were talking about. You know, Tom Dunn for me had this very warm sound on air, like you were really certain and sure that he was going to deliver this amazing selection of sounds. With Donald and Ian, it was different again. It was left of centre. It was very sort of twilight, midnight kind of radio listening. His voice was almost a whisper at times, and he would just sort of reliably tell you that this was a great track and, you know, you should definitely be listening to it. And a lot of the time, I mean, we didn't have Shazam. I mean, the internet was in its infancy. Napster was only just beginning to take off, really, and there wasn't anything like Spotify. So a lot of the time, I didn't even listen to the names of the bands, because particularly with Donald and Ian's show, they were so left of centre for me that I just accepted that he was again just offering up this really, really great selection, and I just got absorbed in it and just listened to it and felt as though this particular man was giving me a window into a world that I wasn't previously aware of or had only been dimly aware of. And for that, it was just real appointment listening, I think is what they call it in radio, when you actually go, I have to turn on the radio now, not because I'm actually near a radio or because I'm driving or something, but because this person is on, because Tom Dunn is on or John Kelly is on or Dylan Dineen is on, because I trust those people. And that's an amazing type of radio.
It's coming out to 9 in LA, 12 in La Paz and 6 in Prague. Shout outs to New York City and London. Without further ado, we shall do what we do from the West Coast for all of you in 100 plus. Let's do it.
Simply got Beats One.
Broadcasting around the world. Eora Musica. Beats One is now live in Los Angeles.
Radio may not be the primary source for new music it was, say, back in 1979 or indeed 1997. However, it certainly still matters, even if it has been pushed down the pecking order. The fact that Apple launched the station to complement its new streaming service demonstrates radio's enduring appeal as a way of introducing new music to an audience. And RTE presenter Dan Hegarty believes this influence will continue into the future.
Well, I think it's about kind of curation and trust now. People listen to you because they have a degree of trust in what you're going to play for them and what you're going to tell them about. So I think that's more the emphasis on it now. It's not absolutely essential like it would have been if your radio broke years ago. It was just a national disaster, or at least it was in my house. There are so many different outlets, but I think radio has to continue to reinvent itself and come up with new ideas. As long as there's still people who are hungry to kind of succeed and just come up with different ways in bringing radio and music radio to people, I think we're in a pretty good place. But I don't think there's any place for complacency, because, you know, you're doomed the minute you think, oh, this is easy.
There is something magical about hearing a great song on the radio for the first time. Just as Tom Dunn had to get out of his bed and stare at the radio when he heard Pretty Vacant back in 77. And just as Talk Talk had Jim Holmes scrambling around his bedsit in the mid-80s looking for a pen and paper after hearing them on The Fanning Show, Tony Fenton got that exact same feeling on a late-night drive home listening to Paul McLoone on Today FM.
I think probably like everybody else, the first time you heard those kind of opening chords and when it kind of kicked in, you realise, well, this is going to be a big tune. It's a, kind of, it just had everything going for it, just sounded great. I played it for the first time on the show. Of course, this is quite late at night, and no sooner had I hit play on the Future Islands track than the phone lit up immediately, and I answered, and it's Tony, and he's obviously driving. He's like, dude. I'm going, Tony, dude, what's the tune? I go, oh, it's Future Islands. Future what? Future Islands. Yeah, what's it called? Future Islands? No, that's the band. Ah, what's the tune called? Seasons Waiting on You. What? Caesar? No, Seasons Waiting on You. And we did this thing, you know, over there. Now, he's obviously driving as well, so I'm like, stay on the phone for too long. But anyway, he gets the details. He goes, okay, Future Islands, Seasons Waiting on You. Okay, gotta go, bye. And that was it. And it was on his show the next day. I just kind of always took a bit of pride in the fact that he heard it on my show, and then it ended up as a staple on his.
That privileged position of getting to introduce new music was something everyone mentioned to me as being one of the real highlights of presenting a late night radio programme. And here's hoping there will always be a space on national radio for presenters like Paul and Dan and Kino Quivon, who celebrates 17 years on air this month, to go left of the dial and soundtrack our sleepless nights. Stick around, because for the next 2 hours, got loads of great music on the way that featured in the documentary. Plus, looking for some of your requests, tracks that remind you of late night radio. 51052 on the text if you want to get involved at TXFM Dublin on Twitter. And you know what? We might hear a few more familiar voices before 9 o'clock as well. For now, we'll leave the final word to Donald Dineen. And the great unknown with radio is when you play a song, you have no idea the effect that one record can have on a listener. And payback for that introduction can come in the most unlikely of places.
I fell off my bike there a few years ago. I had to go to accident and emergency, and was like, it was Saturday night and there's hundreds of people there. There's like everybody who's lost 10-0 in the game of Saturday night are in the matter. So I go in, give my name, and I'm at the back of the queue, and then all of a sudden there's like Donald and Ian, and I'm thinking I better not just sort of march past all these people. So I kind of like go to the desk and they say, oh, they're going to see you now. So I went in, and again, you don't say, but like I'm last in the queue. But I just got my stitches and I got stitched up, and this really nice doctor, and like I'm kind of like, thank you so much. And on the way out, he asked me if there was anything like Stina Nordenstam that I could recommend. So, you know, that's a sign of the ripples that would start somewhere. I'm sure it's in the Hippocratic Oath that you can't declare your love for a radio programme until after you stitch the presenter's leg up. But so, yeah, it was funny. It was funny. And it was specifically about Stina Nordenstam. So, yeah, I very happily sat down and wrote out a list of things to recommend on that basis.